Hello, and welcome back to the H-Span podcast, your go-to podcast for longevity policy discussions. I'm your host, Dylan Livingston. Today, I am sitting down with Dr. George Sutphin, Assistant Professor of Molecular and Cellular Biology at the BIO5 Institute at the University of Arizona. In this episode, we discuss Dr. Sutphin's journey from aerospace engineering into geroscience, his lab's research into influencing aging, and fields of research he is most excited about in the field of longevity. Without further ado, here's Dr. George Sutphin.
Live long and prosper.
All right, George Sutphin, thank you so much for joining us today on the
Thanks
H.
for having me.
Yeah,
Yeah, looking
absolutely.
forward to it.
George, we've known each other for a couple months now, and the more I get to know about you, the more I'm impressed by your background and the work that you're doing in the aging field. So, can you start us off a little bit, give us the background of George Sutphin. How did you get involved with the biology of aging? What career developments led you to where you are now at the Sutphin Lab?
Yeah, so I've been interested in aging since I was a kid through my father, actually. He
Ooh.
was not a scientist in any sense. He was a bus driver, so he was a layperson, but he got interested in the longevity science and aging science. And so this was back in like the 80s and 90s. I think he was even at one point looking at taking human growth hormone. I think he did that for a while when that was the big thing going on. And so he had always told me that I should go into genetics because that's where the next big wave was going to be. Being a teenager and having my own ideas, of course, I went into engineering and did something completely different for a while. So I got fascinated originally by space and space science. So I went into my undergraduate and then into a PhD program in aeronautics and astronautics. I wanted to build rockets and spaceships and the next generation of space travel. And in graduate school, this kind of old interest that I had and conversations with my father growing up came back, and I started getting interested in the field. I think from people outside the field, especially at the time, some of the bias that there's a lot of kind of snake oil and there's no real science here. And
And when was that, George, out of curiosity? When did you?
early 2000s, I got my bachelor in science in 2004. So this is probably like 2005, 2006, that era. So I think I had this bias that this field is not real science and there's nothing really going on here. There's not much we can do about aging. But my interest was rekindled and I started reading about it. And this was a time where we were a decade out from where we discovered the first single gene intervention that could extend lifespan. And there was real science going on here. This is a growing and kind of active and energetic field. So I was surprised at first, and then as I got more into it, I realized I was reading more about aging science than my engineering work. And at some point, a light bulb went off and said, okay, this is what I want to do. So I went down to the other side of campus at the University of Washington and started talking to the various folks down there doing aging work, and eventually switched into a PhD program. Spent a year with Matt Haberlein as a tech, and then joined his lab as a graduate student. And that's where I got my start, and I've been working on aging ever since.
Aging is the ultimate engineering problem, right? So it's good to have these different perspectives coming into the field for sure. That's the way I look at it. This is a multifaceted and very complex issue. And ro rockets might seem a little easier in some regards. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but the complexities of
Perhaps in
the
retrospect, yeah,
body.
the complexity of biology is certainly at a different level and of a different type than in the engineering world.
But it's good to have people with an engineering eye looking at this issue, I believe. I'm glad that you're in the aging field, George. Thank you for making that decision. Let me ask you this that now. So you run the Sutphin Lab at the University of Arizona. You left off that you were a postgrad at the University of Washington. How did you make the jump from University of Washington to University of Arizona? And then can you talk a little bit about what your lab focuses on?
Yeah, so at the University of Washington, I worked primarily in C. elegans and yeast, looking at just genetics of aging. We did some work on caffeine extending lifespan, did some work on some of the kind of classic aging pathways, did some work on sirtuins and a few other places.
Let
And
me
then,
ask you a question. Hold on. Does
yeah,
caffeine extend lifespan? Because
it
I'm aware
does.
it
It does
does.
in worms. We don't know in other species, though. If you look at demographics, there's a pretty decent correlation at the demographic level with those who consume caffeine up to at least a couple cups of coffee a day equivalent. there's a reduction in all-cause mortality. And now that comes with all the caveats of demographic data and kind of epidemiology data, where it's probably confounded by some things, but it's been pretty consistent. So I think there's a shot that it's good for you. And especially in something like Alzheimer's disease, the data suggests that there's a protective effect, increasing caffeine consumption.
All right, I'm gonna live forever then, because I drink 20 cups of coffee a day.
Me too. So.
I'm in good company.
Yep.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No problem.
You were studying C. elegans and caffeine, and I stopped you there.
Yeah. Then when I did my postdoc, I wanted to. So when you find something in C. elegans or yeast or fruit flies or one of these invertebrate models, you ultimately have to test those ideas in a mammalian system before you can move on to human clinical trials or something like that. So I wanted to learn the biology around that next step. I did my postdoctoral work with Ron Crestagna at the Jackson Laboratory. So he's currently a co-director of their shock center. And I worked a lot with Gary Churchill over there as well while I was there. And there I went to learn how to do mouse aging and do that next step. We ended up doing a couple lifespan studies. They were actually looking for someone to do a C. elegans screen for them. So I continued my work in C. elegans, doing a genetic screen while I was there. And it was actually not the mouse work, but the C. elegans work there that led to the discoveries that I founded my own lab around. So just the quick background on that, we took human data. We looked for genes that it changed expression in whole blood with age. And this was in a big set of cohort population through the CHARGE consortium. So that's a collaboration of different human cohorts. And so we screened about 100 genes that had a significant change in expression with age. So that gives you a correlation, but we wanted to know, okay, which of these genes maybe were causally related with it to aging. So we used C. elegans, we knocked those genes down, and our top hit was this enzyme in tryptophan metabolism. So you knock it down, you get about a 20-25% lifespan extension in worms. And so based on that discovery, I've basically built my lab around, at least the first focus of the lab was to understand what this tryptophan metabolic pathway, which is called kynurenine metabolism, and what that's doing with in aging, and can we target it to extend lifespan. Most of the work we've done over the past 6 years, I joined the University of Arizona in 2018 as faculty, and most of the work has been really focused on this one molecule in tryptophan metabolism. It's one of the derivatives of tryptophan. It's called 3-hydroxyanthranilic acid. We can call it 3-HAA. And that seems to extend lifespan in worms through a couple of mechanisms. And then we have some more recent data that it seems to also work in mice. So we're now kind of that my two training in worms and mice, we're doing both of those things and starting to move this closer to to human translation, hopefully.
Beautiful. George, can you also discuss a little bit about what you're doing at the American Aging Association? I know that you guys are one of the leading nonprofit organizations for academics in this space. And so, can you talk about what Age does and the work that you guys are trying to get done?
Yeah, absolutely. So my other hat outside of the lab is I'm the CEO and chair of American Aging Association. Took over that role about a year ago. I've been on the board, I think, since my first year. I started as faculty at the University of Arizona, and then I was involved as a trainee before that. The Age annual meeting is by far my favorite conference, and I think the first one that I attended back when I switched over in 2008 or something like that. So what is Age? We are one of the larger associations that certainly, well, I think we're maybe the largest that's specifically focused on the biology of aging. But our mission has a few points: to promote biological aging research and support scientists. So we're primarily a organization of academic scientists, though more and more we have longevity biotech involved, and we're trying to build that connection with the biotech industry. Now, perhaps with groups like A4LI that are doing more of the policy and social side of the equation. Part of our mission is to be a source of scientifically valid information for aging and aging science and promote accurate science and communication, certainly to the public and physicians. But in my mind, that also includes public representatives as an extension of the public communication part of that. And your work through A4LI, I think there's a lot of potential there for communication between us and forward. And then I think the part of our mission that is perhaps the most exciting and the place where we've had the most growth is supporting trainees and upcoming scientists, the next generation of scientists, We have a very active trainee chapter that's self-governed by the postdocs and the graduate students and some undergraduate students in the field. Those who are just at the early stages in their career, developing their ideas and starting to build their own focus on aging. And we've talked about this. I know you've talked about this with other guests, but I think just the energy coming in for the new generations of scientists in this field is going to transform the field and is one of the most exciting things happening. That is probably our biggest place of growth and one of the most exciting things we're doing out there.
So where are these trainees from? Do they come in as aging biologists or like yourself? Are they coming from different disciplines? And then they're being trained as aging biologists based on their background.
I think there's a mix. A lot of them are in labs that are currently focusing on aging. So probably the bulk are postdocs and graduate students in laboratories like mine and other academic scientists in the field who are doing aging research. So that's probably the biggest draw. But more and more, we have people coming from other disciplines. We mentioned that I come from an engineering background. I think in my department, the last four people we've hired, myself included, were all hires that came from more traditionally quantitative backgrounds, physics, math. And I think aging is drawing people from those other disciplines. Biology is becoming more and more both interdisciplinary, aging is certainly among them, but also quantitative with the advent of AI and modern statistical methods and omics. So I think we are drawing more and more from the traditionally quantitative disciplines as biology becomes a quantitative discipline.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have a lot of friends who started out in AI researchers or physicists, right, that are now either have jobs or are working in labs in the field. So it's like I said before, having these different eyes on this problem where maybe a biologist is banging their head over and over again because they, you know, are looking at it through the lens of a biologist.
Yeah.
You know, having that other perspective can be really game changing. So it's good to see that people with these, you know, other disciplines are getting involved. It's a nice.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, it just helps having different perspectives and different ways of thinking about the problems. Well, it'll only be good for the field.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this. AI is obviously the hot topic these days. So do you use AI at the Sutphen Lab? Are you bullish on its potential to revolutionize longevity medicine, healthcare, et cetera? What do you use it for?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different ways to approach that. So certainly we use AI. The way we primarily use it is through image recognition. I mentioned we have a C. elegans robotic system that we can measure lifespan and health span and hopefully soon fluorescent biomarkers. And so we extensively use image recognition AI to figure out where the animals are and how much they're moving and their levels of expression of various fluorophores. I think that's where we've used it the most. But I think we will start to see more and more use applying language models and whatever the next generation of these things are to start doing some of the hypothesis generation, scour the literature, scour these high content data sets that are, if you can combine all of the omics data we currently have on aging, there's no way one person can go through that stuff, right? But an AI potentially can and right. Use that to build models and generate hypotheses. So people are already starting to do that. And that's where I think we will see more and more use and more power coming out of the AI systems.
I'm excited for the AI overlords. Let me tell you that.
Right. Yeah, we have to say good things about them now.
Whenever I get mad at ChatGPT, I say sorry after when it doesn't do what I want. I say, hey,
yeah,
you know,
you're prepared.
Yeah, when you become sentient, remember I said sorry to you. And so let me ask you this. There are a number of companies in the space that are looking to test their therapeutics in non-human primates or maybe a step. There's a lot of studies, obviously, as with Matt Caberline in dogs.
Yep.
Is there any sort of focus on taking that another step from mice and going to another set of animals, or is mice where, you know, in academia, at least, or at least for you guys, where you're going to kind of focus on?
That's a good question. And I think that the minimum you have to do to start doing clinical work is show something works in mice. I think there's some routes you can use through cultured cells, but showing an intervention works in a mouse model, we've primarily just done like healthy mice lifespan studies, but you could also pick your favorite disease model to look at. We'd like to look at Alzheimer's disease and a couple of other inflammatory diseases in mice. That's the minimum step. But this is an endogenous metabolite. It's something our bodies make naturally, and it has a good safety profile. And I think this would be a potentially a good candidate for something like a future dog aging study, a clinical trial, or a primate study as an intermediate. Those, of course, take a little longer. So we'd probably also pursue like disease-specific clinical trial in the meantime. But I think all of the above approach is useful here to learn as much as we can about these.
Sure, absolutely. And so taking the tryptophan and getting it into the hands of patients, are you guys working to spin this out as like a company of any sorts, or are you working with a biotech sharing IP? How does this, what's your plan for getting this into the clinic?
Yeah, we're starting to look at founding our own startup to look at this. Since this came out of a C. elegans background, one of the things we do in the lab is high throughput screening in C. elegans. We have one of the C. elegans automated robotic systems where we can do high throughput screening in worms. What I'd like to do is have a build a company around a pipeline where we do that initial screening in worms, use the hits that come out of that to do the preclinical testing in mice. You can do that internally or through partnerships with other companies, and then eventually move into early clinical trials. Probably we'd use the 3-HAA, since we already have a hit in this tryptophan pathway, as a first place to start looking at those kind of later preclinical, earlier clinical stage. And that's something we could do internally. Very early stages. We don't have funding or anything like that, but we are looking at moving in that direction. Yeah.
Beautiful. So I have a question not on the biology of aging necessarily or what you're doing at the Sutphen Lab. I know the University of Arizona for being a lot of fun, I've heard. I've had friends who went there. It's a big sports school, right? What's the startup innovation ecosystem like at the University of Arizona? Is it growing? Is it a school that people maybe think of as a sports school, but really is taking off in the academic world? Tell me a little bit about the University of Arizona.
Yeah, I think especially on the tech transfer side, like commercialization of products. So this is the only system I've worked with, which is the caveat, but talking to colleagues at other universities, I think our tech transfer office, which is called TechLaunch Arizona, seems to be one of the better ones out there.
Nice.
They are very active at hunting down busy faculty and figuring out what their innovations are and really helping them do a lot of that early legwork. For someone like me, I've been in academia my whole career. I don't really know the business side. This probably wouldn't have happened without the Tech Launch office and having their act together and being organized and being able to reach out and make business contacts. I think this is an effort that started maybe 10 or so years ago. They put a big investment into their Tech Launch, and just that they've been doing a lot of work to commercialize discoveries that are coming out. I think that's one of our strengths. Yeah.
Let me ask you one more question. And this again, this I guess is more of a fun question, but you come from a space background originally, and you might have seen on Twitter that Elon Musk, every time longevity is brought up, he tends to have a negative opinion about it. Have you made any efforts to talk to Elon and tell him that we need longevity if we're going to go live on Mars? Because I feel like he should know that.
Not personally, though. Yeah, I have seen his comments. He seems to be one of the more pessimistic among the billionaire class in the longevity space. That I don't know. Given that he gets things done, it would maybe be nice to have him on board. But we have other folks in that place that are making investments, so I don't think we are without supporters
That's true.
among the folks with a lot of resources. You
Would
see
be nice.
Palo Alto and Altos, and there's a new one coming out of Boston, I think. I can never remember the name, that's just getting set up, that's backed by like Michael Dell and a couple of others.
I got to write that down for later.
Arena BioWorks, I think, is what it's called. I actually don't know much about it, but I saw that another one was emerging with a $500 million budget or something like that.
Yeah, there is definitely an influx of capital into the field. It's not, we're not lacking. He brings the he's got the following. I think if Elon Musk turns into a longevity supporter, the 80 million people that follow him on Twitter probably will too.
Right. Yeah, we'd get the public support and the public attention if we did
Right.
that.
I
It's
only
kind of one
ask
of
you
our.
because you're a space guy, so maybe you have an inside track there. He'll listen to you. I don't know, but
No,
maybe.
I got out of the rocket industry just at the wrong time, right before it exploded. But I like where I am, so I think it worked out well. And now we're in another growth industry. So.
Absolutely. I always say that getting into longevity now is like getting into AI back in 2008. If you're not early, you're late. That's the mindset that I have there. And just so you know, I'm happy you're not doing rockets either, by the way.
Yeah, ultimately, I am too, though.
Yeah. Nice.
If we fix aging, I can go back to it.
Yeah, there you go. And more time to do other things. That's what
Right there.
longevity gives you. Cool. I want to dive into the next topic here. And I think I might know what one of your answers will be to this question, but I'll ask it anyways. So, which technologies, which interventions that you've been seeing, which give you the most hope for the future? Which excites you the most? Which do you think has the biggest chance to make an impact in the shortest time frame?
Yeah, so I think the shortest time frame is important. So I had maybe three answers to your question. In the short term, I think that there are places where there's already activity that I think is going to have an impact. The first place I think is the efforts to do health optimization. So you see this growing industry of longevity clinics and concierge health where people can pay in and then do a deep dive on what supplements they're lacking, where can they hedge up their health. What's the right diet? What's the right exercise program? We know a lot about things that can potentially help us age better, exercise more, eat a better diet, that sort of thing. But most of us don't do that. So I think that these sorts of efforts are trying to figure out what are the right set of things we can do now to move health. So I think that's probably first phase where we're probably not going to have a big impact in terms of number of years, but maybe we can get improved health. And there's something we can do now and build out these systems. And that hopefully will create some infrastructure for places to now apply the interventions that we're discovering through the science, the research areas. So that's one. What we really need there is democratization. So once we figure out how to do that, can we get insurance companies involved in real preventative medicine? Can we shift policy toward more preventative approaches to medicine, which, in my opinion, aging medicine is preventative medicine. It's or
Agreed.
one of the same. So that's the first answer, I would say. The second answer is in the maybe slightly longer time, we have a bunch of things that are in the early clinical trials or already approved for other indications that I think will, again, be in this category where we're going to have a small-ish like impact in terms of absolute change in lifespan, but a meaningful impact. So these things are things like rapamycin, possibly something like the GLP-1 agonists, which, especially in a society where a high percentage of us are metabolically unhealthy, I think that has a high potential to improve overall health and extend lifespan in our population, whether it will work in otherwise healthy individuals. I think that remains to be seen. And then things like maybe senolytics, which are in a little earlier stage clinical trial, and other drugs that are based on aging science and coming. So I see these as things that will probably be the first line of actual therapeutics in the anti-aging space. But if you look across the research and look at the effect size in mice, I think none of the things we have right now are going to be the big hitters. We've known for decades that you can do caloric restriction in mice, and none of the drugs we have come close to that, the extension you can get through just caloric restriction. So that's first phase. And then the third answer is I think the where we're going to see really big effects are in the spaces where maybe we aren't looking yet. So we've got a lot of effort going into the hallmarks of aging. I think the framework of the hallmarks of aging has really helped focus the field and done a lot to build out a framework for looking. But I also think they're incomplete, and there's going to be a lot of stuff outside of the current hallmarks that we really need to reinvest in discovery research, early stage, find new things that are going to have effects. And I think that discovery research is potentially where we're going to have bigger impacts, but we don't know what they are yet. And a part of that is also combining therapeutics, so doing combinatorial therapies where you can hit multiple categories of age-associated molecular decline simultaneously and potentially have that synergistic impact. And in my view, these are the areas where you're going to ultimately, on a little longer horizon, have the biggest impact. But we need to invest in them now in order for that to work.
When Matt Caberline came and spoke at ARF in 2024, he put up a picture of the map of the world in 300 BC.
Yeah.
I've even heard this one, but I think it's so such a beautiful comparison. He said the map of the world in 300 BC was useful for sailors to use to navigate and trade and all that good stuff, but we obviously know now that the map of the world in 300 BC was nowhere near complete and probably not even accurate in what they had. I agree with you, and I think that's where the government plays is going should be playing a big role at the very least in this foundational discovery work.
Yeah.
That's
I like that analogy because I think it hits these three areas I've talked about. We have enough information to start making progress and start having an impact. We know enough. We have enough of the detail and the map figured out, but the map's not accurate. It's not complete. And once we move more to a Google Maps version of that map of aging, we'll be able to have a much bigger impact. So we need to be doing both, like all sides of the equation, right? Investing in what we think is going to work already, but also investing in filling out the missing detail.
Yep, agreed. Yeah, it's what can we do now and what can we do that will make things better in 10 years? There's both sides of the equation, but we definitely want to be getting people therapeutics and interventions and all that kind of stuff as soon as possible. Because at the end of the day, this is about having people live healthier for as long as they can. So.
Yeah. Right.
Let me ask. So you brought up the 9, 13. There's I think 7. It's always changing. Like you said, I think 13 is the last, or 15 might be the last hallmarks.
Yep.
Anyways, you talked about the hallmarks of aging. Are you particularly bullish on one of those hallmarks? I know that like cellular reprogramming is, in a lot of people's opinion, has the home run potential. Do you agree with that assessment? Are there other hallmarks that you're really bullish on? If there was one. If you had $5 billion and someone said invest into only one hallmark of aging, which one would you
choose? Yes, I think that's the wrong approach for sure.
Okay.
But if I had to pick one, I think I would probably settle on the inflammation and inflammatory disease. I think that's one that crops up in virtually every disease we look at. It's driven by senescent cells, so it's connected through some of these other processes. Mitochondrial dysfunction is, I think it's one of the most interconnected ones and one we seek across all of the diseases of aging. If we could figure out how to tamp down that chronic inflammation, I think you could have a pretty big impact. But I also think that we should be investing both in understanding how each hallmark, what we can do within each hallmark. I think there's actually a lot of investment going on there, and that when we've been done, we're doing a good job at really filling out the detail of those hallmarks. Mm-hmm. But then I think understanding how they interact and what the interaction points that we can find that hit multiple hallmarks, and then again, look outside of them. I think the hallmarks have been great at focusing the field, but they've also created a looking for your keys under the lamppost sort of problem, where it creates almost a lazy approach to science, where, okay, we're going to look at all the hallmarks and then we're going to say that's aging, where, you know, these things are involved. But I think there's a lot we're missing outside of those hallmarks. And if we don't invest in those areas as well, we won't ever have a complete picture. So,
right.
So both of those things.
That was a gun to your head situation. I know you probably would have allocated that $5 billion elsewhere, but that's what I'm here for, to ask the tough question.
That's right. That's right.
Right. Cool. Okay. So I want to shift our focus a little bit to some of the societal, and I like to think about the geopolitical implications of longevity and aging medicine. I think as a politico, at least, that's the thing that fascinates me the most. We are in a world now where every year more and more negative data is coming out about how rapidly our society is aging, how
Yep.
our fertility rates are dropping, and this is the world that we're continuing to march into. I like to think of this as a geopolitical competition between states. Do you think of that at all? Do you see the sort of competition between nation states as either a driving force for why the US should be more? Do you even think about that at all? Is that something that crosses your mind?
Yeah, sure. You've seen investment coming from various quarters. I think the US is probably still in the lead with a lot of investment in biotech, especially, and NIH, even though as the specific investment in biology of aging and NIA is probably, as a percentage of our investment, lower than it ought to be, given that age is the driving factor for all these diseases, we are still one of the biggest investors in aging research. But if we don't start to increase that investment, I don't think that's going to be true for long, with things like Saudi Arabia investing through the Evolution Foundation. And they invest to the level where they're saying they're going to invest, they will be, what, threefold what NIA invest in biology of aging research. I am hopeful that sort of move puts pressure on us to do a better job at investing in this area. And there's certainly other countries, European countries, Germany and France and UK and Belgium and some other places that are making investments in this area. I think it's just good for the field. I don't know if within the field there's as much of a competitive attitude. I would say it's more of a, we're all trying to push in the same direction. But hopefully at the level of the governments, it creates some competitive incentive to the one major investor in that.
Vladimir Putin directed his health minister about a month and a half ago
Oh, really?
to find an anti-aging medicine. And so
Okay.
that was a gift to me, and
Yeah.
that we could tout that and say, hey guys, we're going to let Putin live longer than us. Come on now.
You know how much he's investing in this area?
I don't. It was a sort of a vague article that I saw. I can't imagine more than the US. It's when the head of the government is telling you to do something, even if you have a little bit less resources, the pressure's on in a way. And so we don't want Vladimir Putin telling us what to do. But
Right.
we're trying to recreate that to some extent with the US government kind of giving direction to the private industry and to NIH to take this more seriously.
I mean, the grand competitions, like the Cold War competitions with Russia for the space race, that drove our development of space technology, right? It certainly couldn't hurt. I'd rather be competing on that front than militarily.
We spoke a little bit about the NIH. I was in close contact with you while we were writing our NILAR white paper. The move by the House Energy and Commerce Republicans to reform the NIH in a very major way caused us as an organization to respond and bring this idea to life of a standalone institute for aging research. With that all being said, like I said, we were in close contact the whole time. What are some things that you can concretely say you would like to see the NIH do more of in the field of aging research and the biology of aging? What would you like to see them focus more on as an institution?
Yeah, maybe I'll ask you a question first and then dig into this. We had this proposal that they were going to get rid of the NIA and replace it with the National Institute of Dementia, was it? A, did you see that as a likely proposition? And then how did you see this as a lever to move your goals forward as A4LI?
I would say, in terms of how likely that exact bill is to pass, I would put that at lower than 10%. There's a lot of forces in government that are preventative in getting something like that done. Unless the election's what, a week away, I guess we'll see what happens in the election. I think that might dictate what happens with that bill. But as of right now, I would say there's a pretty slim chance that bill gets enacted as is.
Sure.
You don't let any crisis go to waste. It's always an opportunity, right? Or you have to at least try to look at it that way. What that did was allow us to get our idea in there. And clearly, the government and Congress is thinking about ways to reform the NIH. And we're looking at this as an opportunity, not as a crisis moment. But again, I expect some movement regarding NIH will happen in the next administration. I just don't know if this bill will be enacted as is, right?
And given that we already have an NIA, National Institute on Aging, what was the impetus to propose a new center in that sense?
It was direct response to the Energy and Commerce Committee. So it really only functions. It could be a standalone institute with the current landscape that's out there, right? Like you could create an NIA and an NILAR. But that NILAR paper was a response to the Energy and Commerce Committee.
Got it.
We're proposing it would be the 16th institute instead of, them cutting down to 15. This is number 16, right? But we're also looking at that paper, assuming that the NIA continues to exist as it is now. That paper is also recommendations for the current NIA. What should you be focusing your time on? Where are some of the gaps for foundational research, for translational research? So, regardless of what happens outside of the NILAR paper, it was a very good exercise for the organization to undergo. And I think, regardless, it's a starting point for getting some reform made.
Yeah, so I think where I see that this proposal is useful, one of the areas in particular is that right now, the NIA, as it stands, about half of its budget or more than half is Alzheimer's money. And I know one of the proposals in that, the NILAR proposal, was to break that out and put that in more of the neuro institutes and then have the NILAR be more focused on aging. And I think that's useful in a couple of ways. It's nice that we have the big budget for Alzheimer's, but in some ways that kind of inflates what it looks like NIA has. There's lots of institutes focused on specific disease or specific tissue categories of disease. And I think the real strength of aging research is that we're trying to intervene in these broader processes that have the potential to impact a large number of diseases simultaneously, either preventative or treatment. And so having so much of the institute focused on one disease dilutes that message in some sense, where it looks like we have this big budget, and it's really we have about half of that budget or 40% or whatever it is that's focused on actual aging research.
Even less.
So I see it would be useful to be able to say this is the actual number amount we're investing and what it is relative to the potential impact so that we can really advocate for increased budget. And then within that institute, I've already rang this bell a few times, but I would like to see increased investment in this early stage discovery research as a fraction of that investment, or perhaps in a fraction of the increase in investment we can get through advocacy, just to rebalance the equation. I see like the science, so as a pyramid of advancement, so that the peak of that pyramid is getting a clinical intervention that is impactful in humans and approved by the FDA and out there so that we can use it. But for every one of those, the next tier of the pyramid is your, what, phase three clinical trials, which have a bunch of those are going to fail. And then under those, it's a bigger pool of interventions, and a bunch of those are going to fail. And that's based on preclinical stuff, which we know, especially in something like Alzheimer's or cancer, the translation rate from mice into humans is not that great. So you have to have a much bigger pool of interventions. And then driving that is the base, which is the understanding of the biology of aging. And if you don't have a sufficient investment in that base, yes, we have a backlog in these intermediate places where there's a lot of things we want to push toward clinical translation. But once we've pushed through those, we still need that underlying research that's feeding the space of molecules and interventions and
right.
systems that will ultimately drive that. And that will also help us identify earlier which ones are going to be more effective. So really having it, and the nice thing is that part of the research is relatively inexpensive. So you can invest maybe an equivalent amount of dollars, but still get that broad base of research that you need to drive the more expensive translational work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I always tell people we just need more shots on target, right? Like you said, it's a game of failing, and most companies are going to have a tough time, and most molecules aren't going to work. If we have 100, one of them is going to work. And if we have 1,000, 10 of them are going to work. And if we have a million of them, I'm not that good at math, but you get the picture.
Right.
But anyways, yes, I definitely agree with you. Let me ask you this now. If you were the director of the NIH, what would be the first thing you did as director?
Of NIH or NIA?
I guess, let's say NIH. Let's say NIH, a little more strings to pull, a few more strings to pull.
There would just be a shift in investment to NIA. That's clearly the first place to go. So let's expand the investment in aging research, and specifically in aging rather than disease-specific research. But then there's been efforts, like I think the Geroscience Interest Group at NIH has been a way to do that indirectly without being at the director level, where we can form partnerships between NIA and other institutes that are driving this idea of aging being the primary factor that drives a lot of the diseases, heart disease, the cardiovascular institute, and so on and so forth. And that is a way to, in some ways, build partnerships where some of the dollars that are in heart disease or cancer can be shared and used to understand these basic processes that are driving the diseases. And I think that's been a good effort. It pushing that idea even harder could be a way to shift that.
The geroscience in the mid 2010s, I feel like that's when the interest in this space bubbled up to a point where things actually were being formed at NIH. But just to go back to what you were saying before, I think there's a very valuable or useful advocacy point that we could make, in that people like Felipe Sierra left the NIA and is obviously now working with Hevolution because of the fact that there's a lack of resources space that the NIH is providing. So just to tie in what we were saying before about the competition, I think that's a point that we as an advocacy organization definitely should try to sell. Like, our top scientists are leaving because we're not putting enough money into this space. There definitely is interest. And I know there's interest beyond just the NIA and geroscience. Like you said, obviously the Geroscience Interest Group, but I've had conversations with folks who are former NCI people and former Division of Alzheimer's people. And there's definitely interest in there. I think part of the issue is there's just not enough money and incentivize people to go work in this space, right? There needs to be an incentive for people to work in this space. And if they can't get a grant funded, then they're going to turn towards the things that they can get funded, right?
Yeah. And the field has grown way out of proportion to the funding available.
Right. There's a lot more people.
The investment is needed. I know we have a lot of investment coming in, but I think we're growing at a rate where we are still fairly underwater in terms of need for investment across the board.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Agreed with you. Yep, that's part of what we're trying to do here at A4LI. I'm glad we have you as a supporter and a thought partner here. I appreciate it, George. Let me look at it. I guess I have one more final question for you.
Yeah.
And this is generally how I like to end my podcast episodes. There's a lot of negativity in the world.
Yeah.
If you turn on the news, you'll be horrified. If the first 5 seconds, there's always something crazy going on. I think people out there are feeling pessimistic about the future. What keeps you going? What gets you excited every day? What gets you out of bed? What do you hope the future will look like? What do you expect the future will look like?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people in the aging space are optimistic or optimists. It attracts optimists because we're looking at long-term problems. And I don't know, if you're hoping to extend a healthy lifespan, that means you like where things are going well enough that you want to be around for them. With all the negativity, I think we're still in a good place. We live in probably the best time so far in human history, regardless of some of the things that are happening that are more negative. And I think being in this industry at a time where it's really just starting to show some exponential growth, it's just really exciting. And I think there's a ton of talent in the field, a ton of new younger voices coming in that are going to just reshape how we think about aging and aging science. And I think we're at a point where it's hard to predict where the field's going to be in the next 5 or 10 years, but it's going to be a lot different than now. And it's going to be a lot bigger, a lot more voices. It's going to be better known across in the public and hopefully the policy space. And I think we're just in an exciting time.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to weed your way through all the noise and the news feeds us negative information because they're playing on our instincts here. And that keeps people's eyes locked to the screen. But there is a lot of good going on in the world. What you're doing at the Sutphin Lab and this field in general is, in my opinion, the brightest spot of humanity. We're really doing work that will impact billions of people, hopefully, and impact people in a way that they'll be able to enjoy their lives for longer and more quality of life. So I agree with you, definitely. And I think it's on us as a society to create that future that we all want. Yeah. With that being said, George, I want to thank you for your time today. Can you leave, do you have any Twitter handles, LinkedIn? Can people follow you anywhere?
Yeah. So I'm not active on Twitter or X. I do have a connection there, but I never post. So it's probably not worth looking at. But my LinkedIn profile is set up. You can just search my name. There aren't many George Sutphins out there. So
unique name. Beautiful. Great. Thank you, George, for making the time today. And I want to thank everybody for taking time and listening to our H-Band podcast with George Sutphin. We will be back in a few weeks. George, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. This is fun. Talk to you soon.
Live long and prosper.
Thank you, Dr. Sutphin, for making time to join us today. And for those of you listening at home, I hope you found this conversation as enlightening and informative as I did. If you have anyone you would like to see make an appearance on our podcast, you can send your suggestions to us at info@a4li.org. H-Band will return in a couple of weeks, but until then, let's live long and prosper.